And I saw we were really going to be separated, and I had never spent a night away from him in 15 years. And I waited for him in my kitchen, waited for him to come home from Morrison's or Ballin or Wallace or Buninyong. All these years I had held him in my arms. Now I was in a cane field roaring in the night, consumed by fire. My father-in-law had died. My husband had told me to piss off. A willy-willy came down the middle of the main street of Charters Towers. Not a big one, only 10 feet high or so. A red, dirty whirlwind that danced and swayed and seemed to release a stockman from its center, although doubtless he had simply limped across the street as the willy-willy descended on him. He came to join us on the footpath. It was a black man, tall as Bakubo, with a clean tartan shirt and white moleskin trousers, one leg shorter than the other. I noted his interest in my navigator and saw them talk to one another, the black man being very insistent even as he looked over Bakuba's shoulder with his one good eye. I made nothing of it, but when the awful moment came, when I abandoned my husband in the street, when he would not even say my name, when I returned to our car to win the race that was not a race, I was slow to realize the black man was in the car. He had been drinking, I clearly smelled that, and I was frightened of him, and Bakuba would not tell him to get out, and so I left Charters Towers, driving very fast, my throat an ache of grief, because I was the willful one who must do what she had set out to do. I was in the wrong. I was a bitch. I bawled my eyes out at 50 miles an hour. Bare left, bare right, bare left, and level crossing. Two creeks and bend across the railway tracks. My navigator must protect me now.
Chapter 3. Lord, what has happened to me? I thought. I have a crippled black fella in the rear and a weeping white woman driving at speeds beyond the law. Between Southern Cross and Homestead, she turned back twice, and I thought both times, thank the Lord, we will all be returned to kiss and make up, and there will be a proper funeral, and the children will have parents. But no, 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 she had to win. She spun the wheel, and we were once more in the Red X, heading through the dust clouds for Mount Isa. And I had no choice but to call the odometer clicks for the same awful grids and drains. We sped past vehicles fresh from showrooms now destroyed. We shook and rattled like pills in an Aspro bottle, but lost nothing except a door handle, also the speedo cable, which might have mattered if the driver had any interest in average miles per hour. My bones were slammed into my bottom. My crown split off my head. We were airborne on the jump-ups, and the leaf springs still held out. At Pentland, there was mud like sticky toffee. A dozen competitors up to their doors. Two extortionists with tractors offering to set them free. Amongst the local picnickers, there was a low-slung drover type with a sign. Undertaker prepared to do any digging job. The blackfellow leaned forward expectantly, and I caught his yellowed, bloodshot eye and thought, I cannot imagine how he sees me. But perhaps that could also be said of Irene Bobbs, who was roaring down into the field of battle, low-geared, high-revved, as we growled and banged across the hidden rocks and hurled wet mud over everything behind us, including the crew of Vanguard Spacemaster 53, who had been our mates last night in the pub. So far, so good. There was a post office in Betts Creek, established 1884. Not a soul in sight. Due to the state of the regulator, Mrs. Bobsey left the motor running and rushed inside to make a call to Beverly. The engine had an occasional cough, and I thought, no one will stop to help us if we stall. I put fresh stockings in the air filter. Dwarfed behind the wheel, Mrs. Bobsey was coughing and spitting, and we had 400 miles to Mount Isa. Creek crossings and, worse than that, certain competitors who had disconnected their brake lights to cause accidents behind. No competitor on that leg will forget the dust coating every surface, the drumming, violent gibber stones like a malevolent spirit with a sledgehammer clouting the bottom of your car. Back in Townsville, they had seemed to think I was a black man. Were they ever vigilant for the signs of impure blood? Confronted by this education, I had never felt so lost. Our rear seat passenger indicated he'd be happy to take the wheel, which induced Mrs. Bobsey to speak at length, lecturing him on his weight, how much fuel he was using, how little he was doing, and why he would be better off walking in the dust with your mates. It seems likely she used the term dead weight. When I next caught his eye, he had turned off all the switches, and there was no human signal I could detect. All else being equal, individuals of a given race are distinguishable from each other in proportion to their familiarity or contact with the race as a whole. So said someone long ago. I would wish this was not ever true, but at this point of the journey, our passenger looked only like a black fella, and I could see no more except, sometimes, the possibility that he had suffered some surgical incision in his tongue. We proceeded through desolation, twisting and turning, through copper-coloured hills. If this was our country's heart, I never saw anything so stony, so empty, so endless, devoid of life other than predatory kites circling, while we sat separately contained, our webs of pain and history hidden from each other. We arrived at 89.3 miles from Mount Isa at that dangerous time of day when the roadside cattle spill like underwater shadows and the deep purple of the sky drains into the mineral rocks, and the most balanced person might see phantoms. We were at 50.6, creek crossing, 49.8, left-right bend across creek. Mrs. Bobsey would never drive into water without first walking it, and for this reason she had changed into her shorts, and thus I spied her lovely calves in the pale, uncertain yellow headlights, so like her sister in a different situation. The water was almost to her knees. I needed no one to instruct me that we would, in normal circumstances, with a functional regulator, have removed the belt from the engine fan. Now it would spray water all over our electrics. We had crossed plenty of creeks since Charter's Towers, and some of those had been risky, but she'd always first walked the creeks, had always plotted the safest course across. When the water had sprayed through the engine, Titch's treatment of the electrics had been enough to keep our tinder dry. Now we lurched lopsided down the bank, and I felt the sudden water flood over my feet. And yet we would get through, it seemed. We bounced once, twice, then stalled. "Oh, no!" she cried. "Oh, shit and fuck!" There seemed no point in rescuing the strip maps, which we left floating on the floor. We abandoned ship, and I sat beside my tiny driver on the bank, listening to the engine hissing in its bath. There was wood smoke in the air, but if it was from a bushfire, there was no light to be seen, and we were passive victims, watching the dusk swallow up our victory. Mrs. Bobsey slapped mosquitoes on her unprotected legs, and asked where was that blackfella hiding. I assumed him gone. Why not? It was his country. My reading suggested that he would not die of thirst or hunger. He could get a feed from this red earth as if it were a grocery store. Soon our Red X competitors came charging at us, and we faced another danger. I exhausted our precious torch batteries, waving them away from our vehicle. Of course, they didn't stop to help us. We watched their red taillights with the secret panic of children abandoned after dark. They fled from us, across the ridge, their headlights washing out across the scrub. Later there would be a moon. But when the human noise came from behind us, it was pitch dark. Then I smelled the backseat breath. When I realized he was not alone, the hair rose on my neck. I sat very still, while our former passenger firmly removed the torch from my hand and popped the bonnet and stared at the battery. Mrs. Bobsey grabbed me urgently. In that moment of extremis, I still had room to feel her chest against my upper arm. "Tools," our man demanded. "Don't give them to him," said Mrs. Bobsey. "They'll sell them." I didn't wish to betray her, but I surrendered the smaller of our two kits. Then I watched as he selected an adjustable spanner and removed the leads from the battery. "What is he doing?" she cried, although she had pushed in very close and knew the answer. We were being relieved of our battery. "They'll sell the lead." "Madam," said our former passenger, "we warm him." "Barkhuber," she cried. I understood my job as a man, but what was I meant to do? I gave up our torch to the robber as we followed along the creek and then down into what might be a billabong in wet season, but now must give good shelter from the wind. Here I made out a band of blacks, perhaps a dozen, including children, camping around a fire, and two scrawny dun-coloured dogs finishing their late afternoon meal. Our passenger placed his burden beside the fire. "Better he no good," he said. "Gotta make him better." Even if I could have overpowered him, it would have made no sense. His two accomplices, one no more than a teenager, the other a sturdy, bearded older man, were clearly not afraid of me. They were now dragging some queer, wiry logs out of the scrub. These they placed parallel on each side of the fire, and on top of this a piece of rusted, corrugated iron. "Don't let them," said Mrs. Bobsey, pulling at my arm. I thought, "Don't let them what?" "Our passenger picked up the battery and held it out, like an offering, above the fire. Stop him, will he?" It was nice to be called Willie, but it was an impractical request, and I could do nothing more manly than stand inquiringly beside him. "Bush generator," he said to me. "We stop and fix him. Bush doctor." It was the first time that he smiled. Mrs. Bobsey pushed closer into the firelight, so her face was illuminated in a way that would have had Clover talking of Caravaggio. Later she would say she had been frightened, not just by the danger to the battery, but by the hostile eyes around her, peering from the dark. When the Lucas battery, Lucas, Prince of Darkness, as the saying goes, when the Lucas 12-volt was placed on the corrugated iron, her shoulders dropped, and the firelight revealed a most profound exhaustion on her dirty face. It was then that two children, two girls, perhaps 5 and 10 years old, were sent to drape a blanket around her shoulders. Clearly she feared the dirt. The girls, in any case, did not thrust their sympathy at her. They observed her from the middle distance, squatting, with their arms around their knees. And only when the moon rose, throwing tangled melaleuca shadows across their faces, was it possible to see their good intentions. The battery was finally removed from the heat and placed on the dirt before us. We were told that he, i.e. the battery, was strong now, and I finally understood they had used heat to get some bounce into the electrons. When our robber returned the battery, it was almost too hot to handle. I rushed it back through the moonlight to the car, with Mrs. Bobsey close beside me, whispering. "What is he, medicine man?" she said. "What next? What do they want?" Just the same, it was she who was the boss. He might know the magic, but it was Mrs. Bobs who must reattach the cables. The battery sparked violently, and she was suddenly angry. "You coming or not?" she asked her benefactor. "We sit down this place," he said, "I think." "No waiting," she said. "Mount Isa next. Big hurry." "Start him," ordered our passenger, making a motion as if cranking up the engine. And of course it started, and of course the generator ran the lights. "Lockie Peterson," he said, and shook her hand. "Irene Bobsey," she said. 1 hour after our engine had failed, we were back on the road again, just me and Irene Bobsey and her small white knees.
Chapter 4. The smell of a rally car, the stink, the whiff, the woo. You will never find the recipe for this pong in the Women's Weekly, but ingredients include petrol, rubber, pollen, dust, orange peel, wrecked banana, armpit, socks, man's body. I drove into the night on the ratchet regulator. My headlights waxed and waned, depending on the engine revs. Beneath us was bulldust, 2 feet thick. It was always smooth and soft-looking, but the Holden banged and thudded like an aluminium dinghy hitting rock. It is a miracle our suspension didn't melt. Sometimes I saw the shock absorbers on the car in front, white-hot, glowing like X-rays. Cattle loomed from the blackness, and if I had rolled or hit a roo, if I killed us all, what then? What would my son and daughter say about me? What did Mummy imagine she was doing? She must have been so selfish, up herself completely. Dunstan came into my mind. I did not imagine I was also in his. My thoughts sometimes left the road, circled the little black girls, their precious blanket. I had not even folded it. I had not thanked them. I imagined myself behaving properly, walking across that bare, hard earth and laying the neat blanket at their feet. I ate caffeine tablets and raisins. The F.J. Holden had a bench seat, and my navigator was sometimes pushed hard against the cardboard box. I thought about the little boy and what we were obliged to do with him. I thought, Buck Huber wants me. I was certain. You cannot be so close to a man and not think about these things. I had lain in bed and listened to him with my sister, and imagined things I should not have. He was on the caffeine, too. He cried wolf for a giant snake as fat as an oil drum. He was seeing things, reporting abos running beside the road in long white shirts. We almost missed a culvert. White ground cell seed floated in the dark like broken pillows. The seed that made my babies had blown against my door. I never regretted it, never wanted any more. I had never expected I might have laughed so much or felt so much. And what we did with our bodies was unimaginable. Titch was the first man on earth to put his mouth down there. I thought he had invented it. What was his plan when he married me? He taught me to drive. He was popular and funny, but who can guess what's going on inside the human skin? He wore long-sleeved shirts, always buttoned to hide his scars, cigarette burns. These were for me to see, to cry for on our wedding night. So this is why he shines, I realized then. So this is why he jokes. I held his perfect head against my breast and had no clue about the damage. We never spoke about what had been done to him, and he would reveal no more about his injuries than he did about his mother. The perpetrator was either Dan with his constant ciggies, or it was Dan leaving him alone with priests and bachelors. In terms of scars, how many had it cost to teach each customer to drive? Had this made him cunning? I thought it was my job to save my husband from his helpless, sunny love. I was his wife, his protector. I'd always honored that sacred vow. But when he wished to give up the Red X on account of that cruel skite, no, no, never. I destroyed a spring on a rocky outcrop, 38.9 miles from Cloncurry, clearly marked. And why was I not warned? Because Buck Huber had been drunk on caffeine, seeing megafauna, whatever that was. In order to repair the spring, we must perform the drill Titch had taught us, lying underneath the car together. We were close by necessity, shoulder to shoulder, sliding the shackle bolt from the oily spring. There could be no such thing as manners when he shoved a block of wood between the spring eye and the floor, and his rough arm was against my cheek, and then we jacked the spring up and moved the eye along the wood until the shackle could be fitted, and then my mouth was on his mouth. Oh, dear Jesus, that's enough. Not even 30 seconds of my life. We'll never speak of this again. He returned to calling out grid and curve and creak, and 2 hours later we were at the Mount Isa control, with only the oil stain on my chest to tell the tale of those minutes when Buck Hooper, his hand above my bottom, had pulled me hard against him. We signed in. Then I was the boss lady, giving orders for refueling. I ran a check on engine compression, which was a waste of money. The Red X drivers with the narrow waists and rolled-up sleeves were much less slick than when we saw them last. They waved. We gave them the false impression that Titch was sleeping in the back. I located a telegraph operator named Mr. Gilbert, working late as a special favor to the drivers. Titch Bobs, care of Mason's Undertakers, Charters Towers. I love you. Sorry. Arriving Darwin tomorrow. The navigator slept beneath the car, me in the back seat, as everybody saw. In the morning I called the kids from the post office. Beverly was comforting. Mr. Gilbert came around the counter to deliver a telegram from Titch. Do not enter Darwin Control. Wait at water supply line, Berry Creek, 181.1 miles on strip map, TD, 14. T. Bobs. I thought, thank God, he is coming to get me. But how will he pay for an air ticket? I telegrammed, no points lost, but would not pay for love. There were outdoor showers at the caravan park. There I spied the top half of Buck Hooper Bear. An awful scar, a scoop from his flesh, a wound made by something like a melon baller. I rolled up coats and blankets in the back seat, so control would imagine the third crew member was fast asleep. We got a push start from some blacks and paid them 10 bob, which they thought was not enough. As we drove out of Mount Isa, the navigator touched my cheek with the back of his broad hand. Don't get ideas, I said. A Jaguar went past at 90 miles an hour. It would be every pedal to the metal until 181.1 miles on strip map. Whatever was going to happen there. Chapter 5. Buck Hooper was a nervous driver. It was only kindness that made him offer to take the wheel between Mount Isa and Darwin. The road was bitumen, as he pointed out, and I would have let him. I should have. It was my own fault that I must drive for hours without a wink of sleep. I lost time. I was slowed by mobs of cattle, 400 at a time, on their way to a ship in Darwin, and thenceforth to their deaths. I supposed average was 44 miles per hour, but you could not hurry through the bullocks, and the Abbo stockmen walked them at the speed they wished to go. These beasts got off the road at night, but there were still stray bullocks and roos and apparitions visible only to my navigator. He said the country had once been occupied by wallabies 20 feet tall. As we approached Darwin, I was slowed once more by cattle. Their escort of blowflies came to feast upon my sweaty face. It was in their company I arrived at the rendezvous described by the telegram, water supply line, Berry Creek, 181.1 miles on strip map TD-14. Here I stopped the car. Due to the jiggered regulator, I had to leave the engine idling. I waited. I saw nothing but red earth, a lonely barbed wire fence, a cluster of old signs, Livingston Airstrip, Humpty Doo, not this way, which I did not understand. There was also Pilot's Mess, an open-sided shed strangled by allamander vine, bright green and yellow flowers. Boys must have died here, Japanese or Australian or both. And now their so-called pilot's mess had been invaded by a mob of blacks and pickaninnies. The steers and drovers pushed on past, so I waited for my husband. The bullocks bumped against the car, and I felt their warm, soft shoving. The passing Abbo stockman could not have guessed that the sweaty white woman could always judge a bullock pretty fair. We brushed and slapped at flies as the minutes passed. Finally, a vehicle came towards us, its lights shining through the dust. Could this be him? In a Volkswagen? He stopped in front, nose to nose. Not him. Where was he? This driver was a dork and dill. Brand new Akubra hat, tight shorts, fat legs, brand new elastic-sided stockman's boots. This was what is called a southern wonder.
"Open up!" he cried.
It was not until he was in amongst the toolkits and fuel cans that I recognised him. "Mr. Dunstan!"
"No, no,"
he winked into my rearview mirror.
"I am Mr. Shearer from Ballarat."
But it was Dunstan, as pale as a funeral director, with that fat moustache occupying all his upper lip. He was pressing something on me, a small purple crepe paper parcel. I was, of course, reminded of an earlier occasion when he had wished to show his appreciation.
"Can you fit a new regulator?"
"You're still at GMH?" I asked him, because I was honestly bewildered by his presence so far from his proper place.
"If GMH knew about this, I'd be a dead man."
I asked had he spoken to my husband.
"You'll see,"
he said, and I thought, what new deceit is this? "You've spoken to him?"
"No one has seen me or spoken to me, okay? Including you. Can you fit the new regulator? It's painted with the proper fairy dust, if you get my meaning."
"This is a regulator?"
"No, it's a string of bloody pearls."
"I'll need a jump start afterwards. Yes, I can fit it."
"By yourself?"
"Where is my husband?"
"You must be the only competitor who would leave their driver stranded."
"Where is he?"
"Don't get your panties in a twist. He's on his way. Now, can you fit that regulator? Do you have the tools?"
As Dunstan asked this last insulting question, Buck Hoover twisted in his seat to fetch the smaller kit.
"As for your navigator," said the Southern Wonder, "he is wanted by the law."
Willie tugged the toolkit free and set it on his lap.
"That is a misrepresentation of the situation," he said quietly.
He lifted the lid and offered me my choice of tools, holding the red metal box as if it contained shortbread or chocolate biscuits. I selected what I needed for the job at hand.
"What if you win, Mr. Buck Hoover?" Dunstan asked. "The newspapers will represent your situation just as I did. Have you thought of what damage this would do? Have you considered your position as a member of the crew?"
I told him we had already lost a driver. Did he intend we should dismiss the navigator too?
"You have not lost a driver, Mrs. Bobbs."
"Last time I saw my husband, he was in Charters Towers."
"Yes, and the next time you see him, you will be very bloody nice to him. That will be in Broome. If anybody asks, he never left the car. He will be there when we cross the finish line."
"We?" I asked him why is a man from General Motors in a Volkswagen, and why is he 3,000 miles from where he should be?
"I'm a backer."
"No, you're not."
"Ask your husband when you see him."
I thought, I've been a dupe. I've been made a mug of. Everybody knows I've been deceived.
"Who got you your sponsors? Do you even know?"
No, I didn't know. I could have wept, but I would not. Not in front of this creature who would not know a regulator from his bumhole. I turned off the ignition. I popped the catch on the bonnet and took my tools and the regulator. And, of course, my navigator was going to assist me with the hot electrics. And I welcomed him, his gentle familiarity and his restraint. I trusted his feelings for me. I trusted his honour and his calm.
You,
said the venomous pencil pusher in the back seat. This is how he addressed my dear and decent friend.
You are Willem August Bakhuba.
I told Dunstan to get off the poor man's back. We had driven 24 hours, and if he would just stop yammering a mo, if we could ever get a jump start, we could still make control on time and let the battery charge.
You placed your crew in jeopardy, he said. You are in arrears with child support.
I asked him, was he still employed by GMH?
There are more important interests in this car.
Your name is Dunstan, not Shearer.
Shut up,
he said, and turned to Bakhuba.
Your life is a grubby mess. When we win, the reporters will find your wife and son. Do you really want to do that to Mr. and Mrs. Bobs? You're shitting over everything. You've got the wrong fellow, Mr. Dunstan, he replied.
And I was pleased that he stepped out of the car, and pleased also that he walked away, up the road. He picked up a stone and threw it far ahead. I had never seen him lose his temper, but I judged it would be a fair explosion when it finally happened. I told Dunstan to piss off and leave us. It was a first for me.
Chapter 6. The last thing I required was alcohol, but beer was the Bobsies' cure for every ailment, and Irene asked would I please accompany her to the pub because she was not comfortable with Dunstan. I said she should stay away from the schemer. That was no can do, as she expressed it. But we could drink here, she said, meaning the old Larapinta Hotel, of which she had, moments before, been loudly critical. She had never seen a place so filthy. I was lucky. I would sleep in the car. It was true. The hotel was a rough and dirty place, perched on long fat legs across from the railway yards, in a sour effluvium of meatworks and flagon wine. It advertised sea views, and there it was indeed, beyond the broken scrub and grass, the misty Timor Sea disappearing in the dusk. In the foreground, across the street, a sign announced there was to be no drinking, no gambling, no humbug. Although this was obviously intended for those behind the rear sign of the sign, scattered groups of blacks gathered around their smoky fires. Mrs. Bobsey's presence made it necessary for her male companions to drink in the so-called Virgin's Parlour. Thank God, I thought, when I beheld the public bar crammed with argumentative, hard-faced whites. I wondered about the single black fella in their midst. He looked exactly the same as that battery doctor fella who had saved our skin. It was him. It must be. He was staring at me across the bar. Better leave here, I thought. Then the toxic, sweaty Dunstan told Mrs. B that he hoped she had locked her vehicle. If not, it would be stripped clean like a chicken carcass. I offered to attend to it. That damned stare was waiting on my return. No longer in the public bar, but in the Virgin's Parlour, where the black man positioned himself with his long back against the wall. He raised his beer to me. Battery doctor? Mr. Red X. Of course, I shook his hand. A penny flew across the room and bounced over the bar. Only later did I think I was the cause of it. You got along the road pretty fast. Lockie? Lockie Peterson? Lockie, come drink with me. Of course, I did not drink, but I wouldn't give offence. I turned to find the wall-faced bartender was already paying close attention. Dog tag, he demanded. He's with us, called Dunstan. My shout. Doesn't matter if he's with the Prince of Bloody Wales. I need to see the certificate of exemption. I don't understand, said Dunstan. "'Why would you?' said the bartender, speaking over his shoulder, as he filled the glass of a young woman who had tattooed herself with nails or darning needles. "Woof, woof," she said, and laughed. "Look here," said Dunstan. "It's all right, mate," the bartender said. "I can see you from down south. All I'm asking, mate, does this chap have his pass, his dog tag?" I turned to find myself the subject of Lockie Peterson's bloodshot yellow eyes. "Better you come," he said.
"You're serving me," said Mrs. Bobsey. "You can serve my navigator, too."
"Show them, Lockie," said the bartender. And the black man paused, considered me, and finally produced from deep in his trouser pocket a crumpled piece of paper which the white man, careless of the wet surface, spread out beneath his hand so I could read. "General Certificate of Exemption. This document entitles the bearer, half-caste Aboriginal, known as Lockie Peterson, 1, to leave Quambie Down Station, 2, to walk freely through town without being arrested, 3, to enter a ship or hotel, individual may not be served, at proprietor's discretion, N.B., speaking in native language prohibited." "Drink, another place," said the black man. He jerked his weathered, handsome head, whose creases all pointed to the joining of his forehead and his nose. "Much better drink another place. Come langer me." Irene had let her mouth drop open. Dunstan suffered a shudder of impatience. My driver ordered the barman to give me anything I wanted. I fancy I will not forget this moment, turning my attention from one actor to the other, at first amused by the size of their mistake. The tattooed woman had barked like a dog when the penny had been thrown. But why? The barman affected great busyness with his beer gun, while he kept his secret eye on me. "Come with me," whispered Dr. Battery, although that is an approximate quotation, and I'm not sure what he said. Then, and many times afterwards, for his diction was rather soft and indistinct, sounding more like his melodic language than my own. He spoke again, and there was such a bad blood odour in the bar, such malice, that I didn't have to understand a word, only that there was nothing to laugh at. The hotel was built high on stumps capped with tin, and the time it took me to arrive at the dark, sour, earth-floored place at the bottom of the stairs was insufficient for me to grasp my situation, except I had been ambushed. By whom, or why, I did not know. I had been set on by an expert, you might say, for it was a Darwin barman's job, just as it had been the Townsville's policeman's, to exercise the finest discrimination. He had read my physiognomy, I suppose, with the same confidence as the previous barmaid who had agreed to serve me lemonade. All this was incredibly upsetting. "You give me 5 quid, Dr. Battery said to me. We drink in camp. You rascal, I thought. I opened my wallet, and as I never kept my money there, it was as empty as I had expected. Irene had arrived at the bottom of the stairs. "Come back up." "No good for him up there," said Lockie. "Don't like blackfellas there."
"Don't be silly," she said, small and neat and frightened. "Come back, Willie. I can't be with Dunstan alone."
"Me two fellas stop here, missus. You give me 5 quid. 1 fleg and 6 beer. Poor fella come drink langer camp with me."
"You don't even drink," she said to me.
"He come back. He stop with me. Look one thing."
"Will he?"
The drinkers upstairs made their own distinct warning thunder, shuffling their railway worker boots across the floor. I looked at Irene's sweet face, her big wet eyes, and saw she was even more frightened of Lockie than she was of Dunstan.
"I'll do what you want," she said. "I'm on your side."
She was so tiny in her pale, bleached overalls.
"You really want me to pay for a flagon?"
"Plag and port," said Dr. Battery. 6 beer, 27 shilling. "You know what you're doing?" she asked, counting out the money into that large, pink-palmed hand. In fact, I was about to be a special guest of those citizens of Darwin who this afternoon were gathered at campfires by the sea, just up the bumpy Bagot Road. As he limped down onto the sand, Dr. Battery explained it was not the best day to come, but never mind. These old men had been waiting all day to get that old fella from the morgue. There they had been met by a big mob of police who would not let them have the body of their relative, a law boss and much respected. The cops wore white socks on their hairy legs. They said the dead man was still a ward of the state. He was a government Aborigine, and they would deal with him dead as they had had cause to deal with him for disorderly behaviour. The flagon and beer were produced, and all seals were checked. Now Dr. Battery, who was neatly dressed in his elastic-sided boots and moleskins, chose a place beside an old, wild-haired fellow sitting cross-legged in his dirty sand-shoes and dusty pants. To me he was courteous, but not friendly. But he and Dr. Battery were immediately whispering to each other close up, while their fellows, most noticeably, looked away as if the last thing on their minds was to eavesdrop. Finally the flagon was given to the next man, who passed it, still unopened, down the line, beyond my ken. The six beer bottles were a different matter. They had definitely become the old man's property, and he would dispense them according to a system very clear to him. He opened the first bottle and poured it into a large enamel pannikin. I imagined the drinker's seriousness was all to do with that sad dead body business, so I sat respectfully to one side, cramped, uncomfortable, bitten by sandflies, not grasping that it was I, Willie Buckhuber, who was the object of all these frowns and worry. When I was instructed to illuminate myself, to place my face close to the fire, I was like a drowning man who's surprised to find the distance from which he views his present situation. I heard the soft wash of the ocean and thought of Indonesia out there beyond the smoke. I heard glass break. Two men were fighting by an isolated campfire, rolling into the flames. Lockie stayed beside me all this time, sipping constantly, quietly. He spoke and was listened to and had a great deal to say. I heard the word Red X and wondered if he was telling the story of the sick battery he had cured. I was not prepared to become the subject of examination. It was distressing, the sudden, unexpected touching of my face. The mob held lighted sticks to better see me. I saw them as well. Indeed, some looked as white as I did. A woman wept. I called to Dr. Battery, but it was he who now set on me, tugging at my shirt, and I felt myself ripped from time and place, and I curled myself into a ball and rolled into the sand, which is where the flashlight found me, and I was attended to by brave little Irene Bobbs, who had come out into the unknown dark to find me.
Chapter 7. You would think Dunstan was married to my husband, the way he spoke. He knew all Titch's secrets, more than me. He was in charge, okay? He forbade me to follow Willie when he disappeared into the night. I would be raped, he said, snatching at my wrist. I would be chopped up with an axe. He rushed at me, then fled the consequences. "Wait there," he said. What had just occurred, I did not know, except the whole bar had slammed the door on my dear friend and crew member. They had been ignorant and vicious, like a clique at Geelong High. You're in, you're out, you're not our friend. It was almost closing time. I waited for Dunstan while he consulted with two policemen, but then he raised a glass, the mongrel. Clearly I was on my own. I pushed through the 6 o'clock swillers as they spilled out onto the street, straight into the headlights of exhausted Red X drivers cruising for a hotel bed. I ran across the mown government grass, towards the sea, entering the yellow sandy track which snaked down through the inky Thai tree scrub.
"Irene!" Dunstan called.
All right, I was relieved that he was behind me. Better late than never. He's going to look after me, I thought. But no, he handed me the bloody torch.
"Watch your feet," he said. "There's broken glass."
Yes, I was afraid of black people. I did not understand what a police torch meant to those who appeared in its white beam. I blundered around the Thai tree. At last I found the Aboriginals, like photos in life, another race caught in a moment of thoughtfulness. But when I saw Willie, I did not recognize him. Why would I? A bare-chested white man curled up like a seahorse, dried out on the sand. I thought, he's dead. Perhaps I shouted. Immediately I was surrounded by murmurs. "Don't cry, don't cry. They been look after that fella." Everyone was eager to lift the white man to his feet, explaining to me, not quite accurately, but very seriously,
"That fella go mad. He been drinking."
What else made sense? All the while the waves lapped gently. The smoke was sweet and the air soft and sickly with plonk, but they been look after that white lady, which I was slow to realize was me. Thus we were escorted, nudged, encouraged all the way up to the road, and politely, safely back to the hotel. I mean, the concrete guttering on the opposite side of the road. The bitumen was no man's land. On the far shore stood a moustached white man, who should have been told years ago, don't wear shorts.
"You're off at 4 a.m., Dunstan said.
"Thanks for telling me my job." Now he followed me without invitation, and although he did not say a word, his titch-titch was close behind me, like an insect in the night. How could he possibly think himself in charge? I knew the way without his help, up the fire escape, along the mesh-floored catwalk high above the leafy yard, where, between the mud-caked Red X cars, a solitary vomiter was hard at work. Dunstan followed me inside and chose one of the beds. I told him, get off. That was for the working crew.
"Irene, be sensible."
In the toilet I found the bowl occupied by another huge green frog. It would not be flushed away. I returned to see Dunstan had shifted to my bed, hands on his potato knees, staring at the man lying opposite him.
"You are clean-sheeted," he said angrily. "Did you know that? Everyone else has lost points."
Why wouldn't I know?
"You simply cannot drive solo for another 28 hours. I forbid it."
"That's for me to decide."
"No, it's not. I'll meet you by that old airfield after you've checked out of control, at Berry Creek. We can co-drive to Broome."
"We'd be disqualified."
"Only if they knew. They won't. Titch will land in Broome an hour before we get there. No harm done."
"No."
"And then your navigator leaves the race."
"That's not your decision." Willie was gazing at Dunstan without particular expression.
"For God's sake," Dunstan said to him, "make yourself decent. Irene, can you hear a word I say?"
"Mrs. Bobs to you."
"You can win if you don't muck it up. Your business will be famous. Your life will change forever. I'll help you drive until Broome. Once Titch lands, you can check in at control. Then, Mrs. Bobs, I require this fellow to withdraw."
"He's the navigator."
"He's a bloody liability."
I thought, here is a pencil pusher, wishing to dismiss the most talented member of the crew. "Mr. Dunstan, do your bosses understand what you are suggesting?"
"Bosses? Which bloody bosses? There are more serious interests in this car than General Motors. If you come in first, there are a number of interested parties."
His moustache and open mouth looked like a smirky sea anemone.
"Irene," he said, "you were very long odds when you left Sydney. You were a great investment.
Titch has put my money on a bet.
Maybe don't tell Titch I told you. We've got bigger problems now. Put your bloody shirt on, man.
Willie opened his mouth wide and dragged at his lower eyelids with fingernails.
He is a black son he has abandoned. He is probably black himself.
My navigator groaned loudly, rolled over twice and sat upright, staring at me.
Irene, said Dunstan. Did you understand what happened in the pub?
Mrs. Bobbs, I said.
He is half-caste, Mrs. Bobbs. Don't you get it? He is being sought for child support. He is a known adulterer. Ha-ha!
Cried the navigator, and drummed his bare feet on the lino floor.
He has been seen consorting with the worst elements in Darwin. The police know who he is. He's a half-caste, or a quadroon, or an octoroon, or a macaroon for all I care. If you were the Reddick sponsors, would you want him representing you?
There's a black man on the 2 bob stamp. His name is 1 pound Jimmy.
Oh, shit. Get real, Irene. You've got 7 hours to sleep.
I thought this was Australia's own car. You can't get more Australian than that. In any case, you better leave.
You want me to tell your husband what you're about to do?
I thought, Dunstan is a shameful disease given me as punishment for infidelity. Yes, I said. Yes, I do. He slammed the door behind him, his brand new heels thumping along the catwalk.
I'm not black, my navigator said quietly. I can't be.
He was seated with his sheet wrapped around his shoulders, his thick, fair hair standing as if electric shocked. I thought, who cares what they think in Darwin?
Well, I know who my father is, my mother, grandparents. I look like my father. I am his son, you see. Why is everybody trying to drive me mad?
Of course you're not black. It doesn't matter to me.
You think it doesn't matter to me?
Now I looked at him and saw the deep black worry showing on his forehead, the same corrugated frown I had observed amongst the drinkers on the beach. If you were black, you'd still be the best navigator in the Red X trial. He had begun to weep, slowly, gently, making dirty trails on his travel-stained cheeks. And then, really honestly, there was nothing left to do but turn out the light and cuddle him. Come on, I said. Squeeze over.
Darwin to Christmas Creek, he said.
He meant the nightmare tomorrow. I know.
872 miles. Then Mardawarra, Broome, Port Hedland.
I would trust you with my life.
I won't let you down, he said,
and I would not let him down either. I pushed up hard against his back and I massaged his head, his neck, his knotted shoulders. I made him sleep. Gently, gently, back in the bathroom, I took down the shower curtain and managed finally to wrap it around the frog. He must have thought his death had come, but I carried him outside and left him to find his freedom. I double-locked the door and lay back down beside my dear old navigator. I was all roiled up.
Part 4. Darwin to Broome, 1,200 miles. Chapter 1. Mud-crusted and cracked like a dried-up waterhole, the leading car in the 1954 Red X trial had been broken into. Mrs. Bobbsey was showering when I found it at 4 in the morning, beneath the brilliant stars, its back door swung wide, a pair of elastic-sided boots, neat and parallel, resting by the rear right tire. Someone was asleep inside, not quite snoring. The 12-volt ceiling light revealed Dr. Battery on the back seat. slender ankles crossed, peacefully asleep. It was my unenviable task to now explain, without being rude, that he must leave his bed. The Lord knows, I thought, how he will take this. And yet he woke pleasantly, in no way embarrassed that the normal odours of a trial car had become those of a public bar. Indeed, he was all business, pulling his boots onto his unexpectedly delicate feet and thoughtfully assessing the stubble on his long chin. No, he had no plans to leave. He come you two, fella. I explained we had a Red X trial to win.
Sure, sure.
No room, I said. Now, as he returned his white stockman's